Okay, so this is Bio 160, and it's Tuesday, February 10th, and I'm not wearing my watch, so we're going to go by that clock, I guess. All right, so your first test is done, and I put all your grades up on Blackboard, so you should know what your grade is. A lot of people looked at their test last time, right afterwards, but if you want to today to look at your tests, you're welcome to do that after class. Right, and certainly I recommend that you do that. I won't pass them back like the quizzes, so you got to see me after class to take a look at your Scantrons. Okay. All right, so you got a feeling for what the tests are like. I didn't look at the statistics at all on there, but there were some pretty good grades. I was happy to see that. All right, does anybody have any questions? We're going over Chapter 4. We started Chapter 4 already. And we're going to have a quiz on Thursday, and I don't know what it has in the syllabus, so let's just say that we're going to have a quiz on Chapter 4, okay, on Thursday, just Chapter 4. So maybe the syllabus says 4 and 5, but let's just have it on Chapter 4. All right? Okay. Well, all right, so don't forget metabolism. Our body runs by chemical reactions, and here is an example of a chemical reaction right here. And the sum of all chemical reactions in the body is what we call metabolism. And we can break metabolism up into two main categories. I pretty much hope this is a review because I'm going to go over it fast. And the two things that you have to add together to get metabolism are anabolism and catabolism. Anabolism is the joining together of molecules, and when we join molecules together, that requires energy. And the opposite of that is catabolism, when we take a large molecule, break it down into smaller ones. That's what we call catabolism, and that releases energy. So energy can come out of those reactions. So here's a pretty interesting kind of reaction that happens in our body all the time. These ring structures right here are very simple sugars. We call these monosaccharides. And your body can put monosaccharides together to make a disaccharide right here. Okay? And in that process of putting molecules together, right, does that require energy or does that release energy? Energy requiring process. All right? And then one last little molecule that we see. What else do we get out of this reaction besides a disaccharide? We start with two monosaccharides. We get a disaccharide. We also get this water molecule. So this kind of synthesis reaction, we call it a dehydration synthesis reaction. And a lot of reactions in your body, right, when we put molecules together, are dehydration synthesis reactions. Water is produced. All right, now, sometimes in your body, we want to break a complex sugar down from a bunch of building blocks into their basic building blocks. We might want to take a disaccharide and break it down into two monosaccharides. What other molecule do we need in order to break this disaccharide down into two monosaccharides? We need water, right? So there's that water. And so we have to break the water apart. One part goes to the first monosaccharide, the hydroxide, and the other part of water ends up on the other monosaccharide. So when you break water apart, we call that a hydrolysis reaction. So the two kinds of reactions that I see right here, going from left to right, is a dehydration synthesis because you're pulling water out. And if you go from right to left, we call that a hydrolysis because you actually have to break water up into two pieces and put the different pieces on the two different monosaccharides. Yeah. Oh, sure. Well, that's too high. Right there. That's good right there, right smack in the middle. Right. Okay, so adding two monosaccharides together, you get a disaccharide plus water. That's called a dehydration synthesis. If you go the reverse way, when you take a disaccharide, break it down into its building blocks, you also have to break water apart. That's called hydrolysis. Okay, hydrolysis reaction. Okay, and I have that on your notes for you, right? Anabolism is a dehydration synthesis, and when you catabolize something, we call that hydrolysis because you're breaking water apart, and those two different parts of the water go into two different locations. All right, so your body does that a number of times for different kinds of molecules. This is for sugar metabolism. Sugar is one kind of important biological molecule in your body. Do you know of another important type of biological molecule in your body, a whole class of molecules? These are sugars. What's another class? Have you ever, for instance, heard of a lipid or a fat? Maybe you've heard of one in particular called a triglyceride. So for instance, if you ever get your blood drawn, they'll measure triglycerides to see how healthy your blood is. And this is how a triglyceride is made. There's something called a fatty acid. So here are three fatty acids, and there's a little molecule here that has three carbons on it. That's what we call a glycerol molecule. And these three fatty acids can be joined with this glycerol because, look, here is an H and an OH. Here's an OH and an H. What do you call OH plus an H? If we put those, that's water, right? So we can take water out of here and water out of here and water out of here, join these fatty acids to glycerol, and we end up with a fat molecule, which is what we call a triglyceride. Triglyceride because it has three fatty acids. So if we take three fatty acids and a glycerol and pull out three water molecules, there should actually be a plus. There's probably a plus sign here in your book. Plus sign right there. What's the gen? There isn't one? Yeah, draw it in there if you want. Okay, what do we call that reaction? When we pull water out of something and make a bigger molecule from smaller ones. Dehydration synthesis reaction. So it's the same reaction all over again. So you don't have to memorize a lot of reactions. All right? When you build large molecules, it's usually a dehydration synthesis. And for instance, if your body wants to break this triglyceride down, you know what? It's the same thing. It's a hydrolysis reaction again, where you break these three water molecules apart, and you break these bonds, and you stick those water molecules in right here, then you end up with the building blocks of a triglyceride, which is glycerol and these three fatty acids. Okay. All right, what's another important kind of molecule? Protein, that's right, that's the third kind. And what's the building block of a protein? Probably before you took this class, you started new, I guess most people would know. Those are amino acids. Amino acids are the building blocks of a protein. Amino acids sort of look like this over here and over here, so I see two amino acids. All right, I'm not going to describe how, you don't have to be able to recognize this, I'm just going over a theme of how we build molecules up and how we break them down. So we break molecules down into their building blocks. The building block of a protein are these amino acids. So if we put amino acids together, we get a dipeptide, right? That's the beginning of a protein molecule because all proteins are made out of amino acids. And when we join molecules together, right? Notice we get an H1, H2, and an O. What's H2O? Water. So when we join amino acids together to make a peptide, that's also a dehydration synthesis reaction. So we don't have to come up with any new kinds of chemistry. Your body is just using the same kind of reaction over and over and over again to make something that's more complicated. So sometimes when we look at a big complicated molecule that has numerous repeating units over and over and over again, like in this case it's two peptides, maybe it could be three or four, or it could even be 1,000 amino acids long, we call that a polymer. Right, if it just has the same building block over and over and over again, that's a polymer. When we make a polymer, it's a dehydration synthesis reaction. When we break a large molecule down, that's a hydrolysis reaction. Yeah.
You have those arrows the same direction from the book.
I like it going both ways. I don't know how come it's going only one way right here. I like it, yeah, going forward as well as reverse. So I tell you what, let's fill those arrows in. Just for fun. This one here I like. So if I was going to name this reaction going from left to right, what would we call that one? What are the two kinds? What are your two choices? It's either going to be a dehydration synthesis or hydrolysis. But going from left to right, that is dehydration synthesis, right? So I'll just abbreviate it. Dehydration, what? Synthesis. And then to go backwards, so I'll draw the arrow in just the way it should be. What is that reaction? That's a hydrolysis. And you saw that those two reactions work very nicely for sugars, for fats, and proteins. And there's even one more kind of molecule, which I don't have a slide of, but even that's how nucleic acids are made, DNA and RNA. When you make a big DNA molecule, it's with a dehydration synthesis. When you break it down, it's a hydrolysis reaction. Okay. All right, so that kind of leads me to a question. What controls metabolism in your body? What's controlling metabolism? We have all these different reactions, all the synthesis reactions and hydrolysis reactions, and maybe they shouldn't be going on at the same time, right? Because if they're going on at the same time, nothing changes. So sometimes your body has to focus on dehydration synthesis. At other times, your body has to focus on hydrolysis reactions. Right? So not all these reactions can happen at the exact same moment because nothing would get done. So there's something that controls the rate of these chemical reactions, and that is an enzyme. Okay, so enzymes control chemical reactions for us. So we've got to learn something about enzymes. Okay, enzymes are proteins. So I could ask you, what's the building block of an enzyme? Amino acid, that's right. All right, so that's what I got right here. Does the study of enzymes fall under the category more of anatomy or physiology? Okay, well, that's good. But I would want to just refresh my memory. What the heck is anatomy? Study of structure, and physiology is the study of function. So when you think of an enzyme, should you think of more structure or function? Structure or function. Okay. And we say it controls metabolism. That's something happening inside your body. So in that point of view, it's really function. Enzymes are functional proteins in your body. They allow things to happen. But we're going to see something interesting here. All right. Enzymes work by lowering what we call the activation energy of a reaction. Some reactions take place very, very slowly. All right. For instance, I'll write this one on the board. Here's a reaction. Here is H2O2. That looks a lot like water, but it's not quite water. This is a chemical that a lot of you have at home. Okay, because when you cut yourself, sometimes you like to clean your cut off with this stuff. This is called hydrogen peroxide. Hydrogen peroxide is H2O2. And H2O2 will break down into oxygen and water, right? We're not creating any elements here. You only see hydrogen and oxygen on both sides of the equation right here. This will happen automatically. Okay, so if you have hydrogen peroxide in your medicine cabinet and it's been in a bottle for the last 20 or 25 years and you open that bottle up, guess what's in the bottle? It's pretty much going to be water, and the oxygen is just going to just diffuse away into the air. You're not going to have much in the way of hydrogen peroxide. So hydrogen peroxide automatically wants to turn into water and oxygen. And what kind of bottle do they put it in so that it slows the process down? A really dark bottle, because even if you shine some light on this hydrogen peroxide, that will speed up the reaction and you'll lose the hydrogen peroxide faster. So don't ever store hydrogen peroxide in a window or something, because it will break down, right? All right, so hydrogen peroxide wants to turn into water and oxygen, but a bottle, right, if I had hydrogen peroxide right there, it might take 20 years to do that. How could we speed up that reaction? Okay. You could heat it up, or you could shine light on it. Maybe if you shake it up, that might increase the rate of the reaction. But why do you have hydrogen peroxide? For instance, if you ever cut yourself, you pour some of that on your cut. And then what happens? Immediately, it starts to bubble. What are those bubbles? Oxygen, and you don't really notice it because it looks like hydrogen peroxide, but it is also making a lot of water as well. So there's something in your finger that is taking something that usually takes 20 years to make happen. How fast? Oh, just within seconds. All right? So I want to talk about that a little bit. So that oxygen that you put in your cut is really good. That has a tendency to kill bacteria, so that helps. And it's foaming, so that helps irrigate a lot of debris that you might have in that cut out of the wound, so that helps prevent infection. And the water that's there, of course, washes bacteria out, so again, that helps prevent infection. So hydrogen peroxide on the outside of your body can be used really nicely medicinally. It helps protect you from bacterial infections. Okay. Well, in your body, there is something called catalase. And catalase is an enzyme. And what you should know about an enzyme is, what does it do to a chemical reaction? What does it do to the rate of a chemical reaction? It speeds it up. It makes it go very fast. All right, so that's really primarily what an enzyme does. It makes a reaction happen very fast. It might take a reaction that could take 20 or 30 years to happen in an instant. That's really nice. All right? Now, what an enzyme can't do is that it can't make a reaction happen that won't happen automatically. Oxygen and water won't automatically make hydrogen peroxide. That won't happen. Okay? Only the forward direction happens. So an enzyme can't make it go backwards, only speed up the rate of that forward reaction. All right, now how does it do that? All right? It does it by lowering the activation energy of a reaction. So I tell you what, let's, just for an analogy, let's think of that really cool car I had when I was in college, right here. Did my car want to roll down the hill all by itself? Yeah? Okay. Does it want to roll up the hill by itself? No. Okay, so going down the hill is like hydrogen peroxide going to water and oxygen. Going uphill would be water and oxygen combining to hydrogen peroxide. That doesn't happen unless you put some energy into it. All right, but now let's just say there are some times I don't want my car to roll down the hill. Maybe I'm in class or something, right? So what can I do to prevent my car from rolling down the hill? I can put the brake on, and I wouldn't trust the brakes in that car. Okay, I would put like a little block right here, a chalk, all right? And so in order to roll down the hill, that block is going to stop it from rolling down the hill, all right? So does, even with this block right here, does my car want to roll down the hill? Yeah, but there's a barrier, right? There's something that's stopping it. How can you get over that barrier? How would you be able to get over this barrier to get my car to roll down the hill, even with a block right there? All right? You could come along with what? A big bus or something and hit my car, and what's going to happen? Yeah, you could, yeah, no, then you're going to say, well, do you have insurance? You know, but it's going to hit my car. What's my car going to do? It's going to hop over the block, and once it gets over the block, what will it do? It's going to go down the hill. All right, so the car can go down the hill if you give it enough energy to get over that block. All right, that's what we call an activation energy barrier in chemical reactions. But what does an enzyme do? An enzyme is really elegant because an enzyme is not acting like this bus. In this analogy here, an enzyme would be doing what? It's reducing the activation energy. The enzyme just takes this block away from the chemical reaction. So now all it needs is what? Just a little push to get it to go downhill. All right, so think of this block right here is activation energy. For a reaction. So a reaction will proceed, but somehow you need to get over this activation energy without an enzyme. Another example maybe would be all this wood that we have in the room right here. It seems like it's stable, right? But it's really not very stable because wood is actually trying to convert into something else. Does anybody know what wood, if we give it a long period of time, what it's going to convert into? Okay. Wood, which is cellulose, is going to decompose into CO2 plus water. These are the carbon atoms that are in this wood. All right, and we're really happy to have these tables right here, but if we wanted to turn all this wood into carbon dioxide and water, what would we have to do? We would have to somehow get over the activation energy barrier by putting energy into the wood. And how would you do that? By like putting a match underneath it or something, right? And once that extra energy is absorbed by the wood, what happens to the wood? it just all burns up, turns into carbon dioxide and water. So wood wants to turn into carbon dioxide and water, but there's something that's preventing it, that activation energy. Okay. All right, so in terms of a chemical reaction, does anybody know how to burn wood at low temperature? It's not really, I don't know if anybody would in here. Haha, sorry about that. But if you put a catalyst on wood, it will turn into carbon dioxide and water at a low temperature. You reduce the activation energy. There's a metal, if you put it on wood, it will burn. That's called zinc. Zinc will actually burn wood. It will burn a hole right through the wood. So in that particular case, that zinc, all right, is acting as a catalyst. Now what about for biological systems? Let's think about how activation energy can be reduced in a biological reaction. So let's say I got two molecules right here. I've got a blue one and a black one. All right, so they're two different molecules, and they can join to form a product, and let's just say here's a product. This is the product right here. See how they're joined together? So when these molecules have to touch each other in just the right way to form a product. All right, but how many different ways can these markers bump into each other if they're just randomly moving around in space? They could bump into each other like that. Will a product form?
Nope.
They could bump into them like that, right? Or like this. Or they could bump into each other like that. Is that the same product? You know what? That's not the same product because this is what we want, like that. All right, so if it bumps in like that, that's the wrong thing. What about like this? Or like this, or like that, or like this. How many different ways can these molecules bump into each other the wrong way? Oh, millions of different ways. And the reaction won't happen. It's only if they, I forgot how it goes, if they bump into each other exactly like this, do you get that exact product. Right? And the chances of that happening is what? If it's just a random process. Really slim. So this is what an enzyme does. An enzyme takes these two reactants and puts them together in exactly the right way so that a product is formed. So you don't have to waste a lot of time, these molecules bumping into each other in all these random ways that don't produce a product. So an enzyme puts substrates together in just the right way that a product forms very fast. All right, so that's what catalase does. All right, it just makes a spot so that water and oxygen can be made very, very fast just because of the shape of these molecules. Okay. So, what does an enzyme do? Let's see. I want to just kind of go over a couple points. What does an enzyme do? It has to do with the rate of a chemical reaction. What does it do? It speeds up the rate of a chemical reaction. And how does it speed up the rate of a chemical reaction? By lowering that activation energy, right? By taking away that block from my tire or putting molecules together in just the right way so that they can form a product. That's what we call decreasing the activation energy. Okay. So let's look at an enzyme. What the heck, what did we say an enzyme is made out of again? A protein. That's right. It's made out of amino acids. And proteins have a particular shape associated with them. So this blue block right here is a protein, and it's got a specific kind of shape, and it sort of looks like a block, except on the top over here it's got some wiggles and squiggles in it. All right, and this right here is what we call the active site of an enzyme, because it is going to have the right kind of shape so that it can bind a substrate. So a substrate in this case is going to be what we call a reactant. So reactants in an enzyme-catalyzed reaction we call substrates. Notice that the active site right here is complementary to the shape of this substrate. So what does that mean? That means that the substrate can actually bind to the enzyme right here. And the way that we talk about or model in our mind what the shape of the substrate is compared to the active site on an enzyme, we use the lock and key model. Right, so based on shape, the shape of these molecules, they will either bind or not bind. Let's say we have another molecule, maybe this one right here. Will that molecule bind to the enzyme? No. And how could you convince me that it won't bind? Oh yeah, look, the shape. Wrong shape. Can't fit in the active site. So there's a nice relationship between the structure of the active site and the structure of the substrate. They have to match, they have to be complementary. So you could use the lock and key model, right? The key has to have the right shape to fit in the lock, and the key has to have the right shape before it will turn it, right? So it's just based on shape. All right, so when the substrate molecule binds, you get another molecule. What's another molecule? Here it is right here. We call this the enzyme substrate complex. So this has to form before the products can be produced by an enzyme. If this doesn't form, no products will be produced. That's all there's to it. Okay, the enzyme substrate complex. And immediately, products are formed and they're kicked out of the active site, and here are the products. So in this reaction, what is changing? What's changing in this reaction? What's changing? What about the substrate? What's happening to the substrate? It's getting used up. What about products? They are appearing. They're forming, right? So in this enzyme-catalyzed reaction, the substrates are being used up and the products are being formed. So the substrate concentration is going down. The product concentration is going up. Now, who can tell me what's the difference in this enzyme before the reaction takes place compared to the enzyme after the reaction has taken place? Take a look at that. That could be a really good, tricky question on a test, because you would say, well, there is no difference in that enzyme. It doesn't change. So since it doesn't change, what can it do with this reaction? It can catalyze it over and over and over again. Right? And so that's another reason why enzyme-catalyzed reactions are fast, because enzymes don't get used up. They just sit there all day long making things happen real fast. As soon as they're done, they can do it over again and over again and over again. All right, so that's some real important things about enzymes. And I think this is an exam figure for you. I think I have that on the printout. All right, so you should know substrate and enzyme. Make sure you know that the shape before and after are the same. And here is a real important step, that enzyme-substrate complex. If that doesn't form, don't forget, products can't form either. All right, so enzymes are not consumed during the reaction. Okay. Now, the shape of this protein right here, we can change that shape by a number of different things. And for instance, you know, I'm going to go home tonight, and I'll probably cook a hamburger out on the barbecue, because I don't like raw hamburgers. Anybody like raw hamburger in here? That's a delicacy in a lot of places, but not necessarily at my house. So I'll put it on the barbecue, and this always happens to me. All right, so my hamburger gets cooked perfectly just when my phone rings, right? So I pick up my phone, I answer my phone, and there's some friends of mine on the phone, and they say, hey, a pool table just opened up. And we only have three players, and we need you to come down and shoot some pool with us. And I say, well, I just got my hamburger cooked. I'm ready to sit down and eat. And does that ever work as an excuse not to go play pool? No. All right, so I took my raw hamburger. I cooked it. Is there a difference between how raw hamburger looks and cooked hamburger? Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so I take my cooked hamburger, and I put it back in the refrigerator because I can't get out of shooting pool, right? Put it in the refrigerator. Does it go back to looking like raw hamburger again?
No.
No, right? Because that process of taking a protein, right? That process of taking a protein, and I'm just going to abstractly draw it on the board, maybe make it look like that, all right? You don't have to copy that exactly. All right, and then when you cook it, what happens to the shape of that protein? Maybe it changes shape, right? It looks different. So this process right here is what we call what? Denaturation. Denaturation. And so by increasing the temperature to about 100 degrees, we can denature that protein. I'll help you in a second. Can denature that protein. And what can you tell me? Should I put an arrow over here?
No.
It's a one-way process, right? That is irreversible. That's irreversible. Okay, once you denature or cook a protein, it can't go back to its original shape. And how did we do that? What did we use to denature that protein in this example? Yeah, heat or temperature, right? Okay. What are some other ways that you can cook a protein at low temperature? Anybody? Huh? Steam is hot. Microwave is hot. Lemon, that's right. Right? You can take some fish and you can make ceviche out of it by putting some lemon on it. And it will look cooked, right? And it will stay, it will preserve the food as well. Right? And what lemon is acid. So when we change the pH of something, that can cause denaturation as well. And that will preserve the food and cook it at low temperature. All right, it changes the shape. What is another method? Okay, yeah, you can pull the water out, or you can pour salt on it. Salt will also denature a protein as well. That's a way to cook something and preserve something. And that also produces something that's irreversible. Now, if this was an enzyme, let's just say that maybe right here, see this thing right here? Let's just say that that was the active site, so that means it could bind something that looks like a triangle right here and convert it into another kind of product, right? But what about the active site once this protein is denatured? What about that triangle? Can it bind anywhere here? No. So if this is an enzyme catalyzing this reaction, what about the activity of this protein right here? After we denature an enzyme, what happens to the activity of it? Okay, it's destroyed, right? It loses its activity. So that's one of the reasons why we cook food, is to preserve food, to destroy all the enzymatic activity so that it doesn't go bad. Okay, so that's some important things about enzymes and proteins. And then this is the last kind of complicated concept to have. All right, so when I asked you, what did I ask you? Does the study of enzymes fall under the category of anatomy or physiology? Okay, we said physiology because it's catalyzing reactions. All right, but remember, very first day in class, we said there's always a relationship between structure and function, right? So if you have a hand and all of a sudden you're missing a couple fingers, it's not going to work like the same hand anymore, right? Okay. Now let's look at this enzyme. It works. It's catalyzing a reaction. It has a certain physiology. Why? Because it has a certain kind of shape associated with it. It has the right shape on the active site that matches up with the substrate. And if we change the shape of this protein, what happens to its physiology? It changes as well. Right, so when we study enzymes, we have to be concerned about not just its function, which is physiology, but the way we understand its physiology is by knowing something about its shape. Right, so if we change the shape of an enzyme, we change the physiology of that enzyme as well. So that's kind of an advanced concept, but I think, did you kind of see what I was talking about there? Right, so there's always a relationship between structure and function. If you change the structure, what happens to function? It changes, even at the molecular level. Okay, so for sure you can see that on a gross anatomy level, but even at a molecular level, that happens.
So, but on the series, if you have a question about, the first question.
Oh, I couldn't give you, there's no simple answer to that. Okay, you would that would be like a question for a dissertation or something. You'd say, oh, there's a relationship between structure and function, and we just can't answer it very simply like that. And if we change the structure of something, that changes the function. And if we want to know how it changes, we got to be really particular to know how the structure changes. Okay? Yeah. So it's not a really simple kind of answer because it's not a simple question. Okay. All right. So let's look at energy metabolism. Let's stop talking about enzymes for a little bit. All right. Energy metabolism. What is the main energy molecule in your body? All right, ATP. And maybe I've talked about ATP. Here is a picture of ATP right here. And ATP has got a couple components to it. I think I'm showing sort of what it looks like. So I'll just tell you what's on here. This right here is a sugar molecule. And this organic molecule right here acts as a base. It's very basic in nature, so we call that a base. And then you see these things right here. in terms of the periodic table, which I forgot to bring for your test. But what does P stand for?
Phosphate.
Okay. So these molecules that are made up by this sugar, right? This is just a ribosugar, and this is a base called adenine. Okay. So here is adenosine. If we put these together, if we take adenosine and put three phosphates on there, we get adenosine 1,2,3-phosphate, which is the same thing as what? Triphosphate. And these little squiggles right here represent bonds, chemical bonds, and they're strong bonds. There's a lot of energy in these bonds. So in order to make this bond, what do you have to do? You got to put energy in. But your body can use that energy, that chemical energy, by doing what? Breaking it, right? Remember anabolism and catabolism? Putting them together requires energy, but if your body breaks these bonds, a lot of energy is released, and your body can use that energy in this chemical bond, for instance, muscle contraction, or to think a thought, or digest food, or all kinds of different kinds of purposes in your body. Any kind of process that requires energy, it can get it from this bond here and this one here, as long as you break it. Okay, so that's the important thing. All right. Now, how much, when your car goes someplace, it requires energy too. Say you're going to drive 25 miles someplace. How much energy do you need in terms of gasoline? You need a gallon, basically, right? You need about a gallon of gasoline to go 20, unless you got a really light car or something, 30 miles, something like that. Okay. So in order for you to go someplace to live for a whole day, how much ATP do you need? So I'm trying to give you a relative feel for how much ATP is required, because we don't run on gasoline, we run on ATP. How much ATP do we need to, yes, you need 40 kilograms. All right, now I don't know how much, if you know what 40 kilograms is, but if you look up in the textbook what a average person weighs, an average person weighs 70 kilograms. It probably hasn't been 30 years since I've weighed 70 kilograms, so that's kind of a smallish person, okay? But that's a textbook, person is. All right, so if we just think of a textbook person that's 70 kilograms, they need 40 kilograms of ATP to stay alive every day. So that's more than half your body weight. So if you just think about you, it's more than half your body weight you need an ATP to run all the processes that are happening inside your body. Okay? So that's a lot. That's a lot of energy. That tells you how important this molecule is. All right? So you don't need like a suitcase of 40 kilograms to stay alive, because as soon as you lose an ATP in your body, all right, it makes it again. Right, so you don't need 40 kilograms at any one particular time. It's just regenerated all day long. We'll talk about that process of regenerating ATP in just a second. All right, but you can probably imagine that your body should regenerate ATP all the time, because you need so much of it all the time. I suppose we could figure out, okay, if we divided 40 kilograms by 24, that would tell you how many kilograms you need per hour, and then divide it again by 60, how much you need per minute. Right? That's a really big number. So here's another way of thinking about how much ATP you need in order to stay alive. ATP is regenerated when oxygen goes to some tissue in your body, and there's an organelle inside of a cell who's responsible for making ATP. And I think you should know who that is. What's the name of that organelle that makes ATP for you all day long and night long? That's the mitochondria, right? Okay, so mitochondria need oxygen in order to do their job. That's why we inhale all the time, to bring oxygen into our bodies so that mitochondria can make ATP. And unfortunately, sometimes that oxygen delivery system is stopped. Like, for instance, when somebody's heart stops beating, right? Their heart isn't pumping, blood isn't going to the brain, so oxygen is not going to the brain. So that means your brain is going to run out of energy. It's going to run out of ATP. And I would like for you to know, how long can you maintain consciousness without blood going to your brain? When do you run out of ATP and you lose consciousness? 3 seconds. your brain runs out of ATP in 3 seconds. And it might be 2 seconds or 4 seconds, 5 seconds, but a good ballpark figure is 3 seconds. Your brain will just run out of energy and you'll lose consciousness. So to me, that's astounding. That's pretty fast.
Yeah.
All right. Now, you also need ATP to stay alive. So after what period of time, if you cut off oxygen to the brain, will the brain actually die? And when remember, when something dies, what happens? Can't ever come back, right? So there's going to be a period of time when somebody is unconscious, but we can still revive them. They'll still be alive, but there's going to also be another period of time when their brain dies. We can't ever get them back. How long can a brain be without oxygen before that brain actually dies? You know what? You're right. So it's 3 seconds and you lose consciousness. After 3 minutes, the brain dies and we can't ever get it back again. That underscores how important this ATP molecule is, right? And also, that kind of underscores how important it is for people to know CPR, because you can extend those periods. Anybody know CPR in here? Yeah, some people, and they're really close. I'm glad to see that, right? Because when somebody's heart stops, people that are trained in CPR, they can beat somebody's heart who's not beating for them by chest compressions, right? And you can ventilate somebody by mouth-to-mouth resuscitation, and you can keep somebody alive for a pretty long period of time so they can get to the hospital, and hopefully in the hospital they can get their heart started up again. So you can really save a lot of people's lives. And that's all due to what? This ATP molecule right here. Okay. So let me see what I got on my notes right here. You require about 40 kilograms a day. The energy metabolism for the synthesis of ATP comes from glucose. Glucose is a very basic kind of sugar molecule that we have in our diet. And glucose metabolism takes the energy in glucose and puts it into ATP so that we can stay alive. And you know what? You know where that happens. What organelle takes glucose with oxygen and makes ATP out of it? That's the mitochondria again. That's the mitochondria. That's the job of the mitochondria. So let's kind of take a look and see what that looks like. All right, so here's that ATP molecule. Here's a chemical reaction. All right, so here is ATP. Don't forget, there is energy in these bonds right here. How do we break a bond again? What's the name of that chemical reaction? Hydrolysis. That's right. That's a hydrolysis reaction, just like we saw before. When water is hydrolyzed, it will split this bond, and there's energy in that bond. So when it's broken, energy is released. That energy is used to basically keep you alive, right? To keep your brain functioning, your muscles contracting. What's an important muscle that you all need to breathe? We haven't talked about it yet. Somebody might know. The diaphragm, right? The diaphragm separates the abdominal cavity from the thoracic cavity. That allows you to inhale. That muscle needs ATP. It breaks ATP down, releases energy. This last phosphate comes off into solution, and what are you left with? Adenosine diphosphate, and we say diphosphate because we only see two phosphate molecules right there. So that's ADP. All right. Well, if all your ATP is converted into ADP, what happens to you? You're dead, right? Because what do you need to stay alive? You need ATP. All right. So don't forget, it's the job of the mitochondria to take ADP and this inorganic phosphate and regenerate this ATP right here. Now, that's the job of the mitochondria. It needs energy. Remember, because this is what? An anabolic reaction, right? This is an anabolic reaction that requires energy. Your mitochondria can make ATP, and that process can just go over and over and over again. And don't forget, your mitochondria, all of the trillions of them, have to make, what, 40 kilograms of this stuff every day to keep you alive. So they're really busy. And what is the energy source that mitochondria need in order to make this ATP right here? Okay, and this is what you get in your diet. You don't have to eat ATP, but you do need to eat glucose. Okay, glucose. This is sort of, maybe I'll just talk a little bit about like sort of an interesting, very sad kind of disease process. There is a disease process where somebody will eat glucose it will go into their blood, but it can't ever leave their blood. It's stuck in their blood. Glucose can't get into the cells. Does anybody know what that pathology is called? That's called diabetes. Yeah, it's diabetes mellitus. So if glucose can't get into the cells, guess what happens to these mitochondria? They can't make ATP, right? So when somebody has diabetes mellitus, their cells are starving for glucose, all right? And that's why diabetes is such a deadly disease to have. It doesn't kill you overnight, all right? But eventually, what can happen? Very metabolic organs like your kidneys, muscles, right, retina will die because those mitochondria can't make enough ATP to keep those organs alive. Even a person's heart, all right, eventually will die. Unless, what, they're treated properly. So, and that could, one possible way might be with insulin, right? So if somebody's a diabetic, they have to control their blood glucose. Not just to control their blood glucose, but so that glucose can get into their cells to make ATP, right? It's a pretty dangerous disease. All right, so how does mitochondria make that ATP? Let's take a look right here. Energy metabolism. All right, well, there are three chemical pathways, right, that can be used to make ATP. Sorry, I had it too high. How's that? A little bit better. All right, so I'm going to tell you the names of these three processes, and then we'll build upon this a little bit. But so I'll have to talk about it a little bit before you can understand what's going on. The three processes, the first one is called glycolysis. All right, and glycolysis, what kind of what word do you see in glycolysis if you just look at that? It kind of looks intimidating, but it shouldn't be too bad. You see lysis, which means what? Breaking apart. And this glyco right here basically just stands for glucose. It's the breaking down of glucose. It actually splits it in half. It splits the molecule into two molecules. So that's what we call glycolysis. Glucose is split into two, and the products that are made are pyruvate and 2-ATP. So does that look like a good reaction because it's making 2-ATP? Yeah, because you need that ATP to stay alive, right? So that's a pretty good reaction. All right, and the enzymes that do that, because you don't want to wait 20 or 30 years to make that glucose, you want it to happen how? Like, yeah, like right now, right? Because you got 3 seconds to regenerate ATP in your brain, right? So it's got to happen right away. Right? These enzymes are in the cytoplasm. In the cytoplasm. What's the cytoplasm of a cell? What can you break a cell down into? The cytosol? Oh, I should have cytosol on this piece of paper right here. Okay. So these enzymes that run glycolysis are in cytosol, not the mitochondria. Alright, so I'm going to put cytosol. Not mitochondria. So mitochondria aren't necessary to make these 2-ATP. All right, there are two other processes. The citric acid cycle and something called electron transport. So the products of glycolysis are passed on, then given to the mitochondria. They enter the mitochondria, and they're metabolized further. And in the mitochondria, from the leftover parts of glucose, the mitochondria can make 34-ATP out of it. Okay, so you got glycolysis that makes 2-ATP. The mitochondria can make 34. So who gets credit for making most of the ATP in your body? It's the mitochondria, because that's where the citric acid cycle is and the electron transport chain. They're inside the mitochondria. All right. So let me talk about what's happening inside the mitochondria. Well, I got to talk about it all together, actually. Okay. There are two main ways that your body can make ATP. Two main ways. And you can kind of see one is in the cytosol, and the other has to do with mitochondria. So you know what? I'm going to put a bracket right here, and I'm just going to abbreviate it mito. What does that stand for? Mitochondria, so the two main ways. All right, and the two main ways are anaerobic respiration, and the second way is aerobic respiration. And we use these terms, okay, because aerobic means with oxygen. All right, so aerobic respiration requires oxygen. Anaerobic respiration does not require oxygen.
No.
Yep, it just doesn't require oxygen. Okay. All right, so anaerobic respiration is when we take glucose and break it down into two pyruvate molecules. Let's see if I have an example right here. Here's a pretty good example. So here is, I don't know if you can see that all at one time, so I'll shift it around. Here is the top of the slide, and then down over here is the bottom of the slide. And this whole thing right here is a cell. That represents a cell. All right, so it's just an illustration with a lot of artistic license applied to it. And then you see there's another chamber inside the cell. On this illustration, it's taking up most of the cell. In real life, it doesn't take up most of the cell. This thing right here is a mitochondria. Right, so here we see the cell, and inside the cell is a mitochondria. What's the job of mitochondria again? Is to make a lot of ATP. Okay. And remember, there are two main parts to making ATP. The first part happens in the cytosol. Oh, look, the slide was labeled properly. I like that. In the cytosol, glucose, which has six carbon atoms on it, that's what those little balls mean right here. It means it's a carbon atom, can get split in half. Glycolysis basically is like taking a scissors and cutting the molecule, where? Right there. And splitting the molecule into two pieces. And when it does, you don't have glucose anymore. What are you left with? You're left with pyruvate. But how many pyruvate? You got two, right? So you got two pyruvate. All right, and don't forget, right, when you break this down, this is a catabolic reaction. Catabolic reactions release energy, and that energy can be used by the cell, right, namely the chemical reactions that we call glycolysis to make 2-ATP. Right, and do you see any oxygen here? No oxygen. So we call that anaerobic respiration. All right. So your body can make 2-ATP as a result of that. Now, the pyruvate can enter the mitochondria. That's what mitochondria need as a substrate. They don't necessarily like glucose. They like pyruvate. All right, so pyruvate enters, and look what happens immediately. Pyruvate has three carbon atoms, all right, and there's another scissors inside this mitochondria, and it chops off one of them, so it's left with two. The two-carbon group is what we call an acetyl group. I don't think you have to know that, but I'll just tell you for fun. Right? Because if you have this acetyl group, that means you have one carbon that's not accounted for. What happened to it? Where did it go? All right. This third carbon gets converted into carbon dioxide. And what could you tell me about carbon dioxide? What kind of compound is it? Is it like a salt crystal, or is it a fluid, liquid? It's a gas, right? Carbon dioxide is a gas. And what does our body do with that carbon dioxide that's produced by these mitochondria? Yeah, we just exhale it out of our body, right? We excrete it when we exhale. So it's a waste product of metabolism that we breathe out of our body by breathing, all right? And in the meantime, then this acetyl group gets donated to what we call the citric acid cycle. All right, and as a result of molecules being rearranged in here, the citric acid cycle produces two more CO2s. So for every pyruvate that enters the mitochondria, how many CO2s are produced? Okay, I see two here plus one here. So every carbon that entered as pyruvic acid gets converted into CO2, and you just breathe that out of your body. All right, but again, when you break molecules down, what's released? Energy is released. And the mitochondria are smart enough, they have figured out a way to use that energy that's being released and make ATP. Okay, so 2-ATP here. And then the third process we call the electron transport chain has to do with taking some electrons from these molecules right here and putting these electrons through a bunch of molecules that actually act as a wire inside the mitochondria. This process right here can make, 34-ATP. So now this process here inside the mitochondria to make all of this ATP requires another molecule besides pyruvate. entering. And that molecule is oxygen. So why is it that we have to inhale? We need to inhale so that these mitochondria get oxygen. We have to exhale so mitochondria can get rid of CO2. And as your body is, as the mitochondria are utilizing oxygen and producing CO2, your body is making, a ton of ATP, 34 ATP for every pyruvate molecule right here to keep your body alive. All right, so what else do I want to show you right here? The last molecule that's formed through this process inside the mitochondria, this is actually kind of fascinating. What's the last molecule that's formed? Not including ATP right here, but what? Water, right? H2O. And that's just the solvent that makes up your body. But water plays an important role in many chemical reactions in your body. Could you give me a name of another chemical reaction that water plays an important role in? How about dehydration synthesis? Yeah, it's a product. What about a hydrolysis reaction? Yeah, water is needed there again. So water is not just the solvent that we're dissolved in, but it's also a very important biological molecule that's involved in almost every chemical reaction in your body one way or another, either being produced or used up. All right, so on this slide right here, we see the two kinds of respiration. The one kind that requires oxygen inside the mitochondria, and the other kind that's in the cytosol that does not require oxygen. So the one that doesn't require oxygen is called, glycolysis or anaerobic respiration. That produces how many ATP? That might have sounded good at the beginning, but is 2 better than 34? No, right? It's a lot smaller, right? Maybe I need to put a little example on the board. I'd rather make 34 ATP out of something than just 2 ATP. Okay? And what's the organ that can produce a lot of ATP? Organelle, I'm sorry. The organelle is mitochondria, as long as what is present? Oxygen. So this is what we call aerobic respiration in mitochondria. So aerobic respiration takes this pyruvate, converts it into CO2, and in the process it makes a lot of ATP. 34 ATP. All right, so let's kind of compare and contrast aerobic and anaerobic respiration in terms of maybe where they take place and all that kind of stuff. Well, you know what? I got to stop and get gasoline on the way home because my gas tank is really low. Hopefully you have a lot of gas in your tank, but the price isn't so bad anymore. So I got a choice of a couple gas stations where I can go and get gas. All right, so gas station A, let's just say that the cost, and gas station B, let's just say that the cost is still going to be what, $5 per gallon? $5 per gallon. I have an expensive car. Okay. At both gas stations. But if I go to gas station A and I buy a gallon of gas, I can get 2 miles on a gallon of gas. Or I can go to gas station B. They sell different gasoline, though it's the same price. Gas station B has a better gas. I can drive 34 miles. Okay? Same. So this is what? Miles per gallon. Right? Miles per gallon. So what gas station am I going to go to? Yeah, right? It's a much better deal. So in your body, can you see what's a much better deal? For every glucose molecule, right, what produces more energy for you? Is it anaerobic respiration or aerobic respiration? Aerobic respiration is much better, right? So organs that require a lot of energy, like your brain and your retina and your kidney, rely on aerobic respiration to make that ATP form, right? And if not, those organs are going to die. Okay. So where does anaerobic respiration take place? Anaerobic. Cytosol. Where does aerobic respiration take place? Mitochondria. And you know what? They didn't label this slide. Let's label it. We're going to say mitochondria right here. Cytosol is anaerobic, anaerobic, and mitochondria are aerobic. And it's aerobic, why? Because it needs that oxygen. Okay, because through this process right here, it's going to take some hydrogens and some electrons and break this oxygen down and make water out of it. That happens inside the mitochondria, but the good thing is what? A lot of ATP to keep you alive. So let's just take a look and see what I said on this slide right here. Okay, anaerobic respiration is what? Glucose through pyruvate. All right, where does this take place?
Cytosol.
Does it require oxygen? No, because that's in the name, right? Anaerobic. And what pathway does it require?
Glycolysis,
right there. You see glycolysis. And glycolysis is what? Glucolysis. Glucolysis is just the splitting of glucose into two molecules. Okay. And what about aerobic respiration? I have the little synopsis right here. Oxygen plus glucose go into all that CO2 and that water and a lot of ATP. All right, where does this take place?
Mitochondria.
Does it require oxygen?
Yes.
You bet. What pathway does it require? Ah, yeah. See, that's a little bit more complicated. You got what? The citric acid cycle and electron transport chain. Okay? Right here. All right, so here's the citric acid cycle, and the electron transport chain produces a lot of ATP for you. Okay? Citric acid cycle and electron transport. Well, we're not going to get into any more details of this citric acid cycle and electron transport. It's fascinating, but you got to take another class, okay, for that, like Bio 241 or something. Okay, so that's what I want you to know about respiration. All right, so here is anaerobic respiration and aerobic respiration, and you can see some of it requires, what, the cytosol, some of it requires the mitochondria, sometimes it needs oxygen, all right? And so it's sort of complicated, but I don't want you to lose the big picture. What's the importance of cellular respiration? Why do we have metabolic pathways for respiration? Why is cellular respiration, why is anaerobic and aerobic respiration important in our bodies? To keep it alive. Why does it keep it alive? Because what happens? Does it produce water? Is that the important reason? No. It does produce water. That's not the important thing. Is it important because it burns up oxygen? Is that the reason why for respiration? Is that the important reason? It utilizes oxygen? No. Is it because respiration produces CO2? Is that the important reason? No. What's the important reason for respiration? To make ATP. That's right. To make ATP. That's what keeps us alive, right? So that's the important reason for respiration. All right. So ATP hydrolysis, is that anabolism or catabolism? This is kind of a review. Hydrolysis is catabolism. All right. And when it's a catabolic reaction, right, when it's going from ATP to ADP, that's catabolism. What else is released?
Energy,
right? And your body uses that energy to stay alive. All right, and then if we take ADP and inorganic phosphate, put them together, okay, that requires energy, right? And it ends up in the ATP molecule. So this right here is what we've just been talking about, taking ADP and making ATP out of it. Via what? Either anaerobic respiration or aerobic respiration. And so you should kind of know where those two processes take place. All right, so respiration is necessary to make ATP right here. Which process is more efficient? Which one produces more ATP? Anaerobic or aerobic?
Aerobic
produces a lot more, right? Gas station B right there. Okay. And give me a way to think about how important ATP is in your body.
A lot.
It's a lot. Because why? Because if you're going to take a test and you couldn't make ATP, you could only work on your test for 3 seconds. Not very good. That's right. So that's why they always say, don't forget to breathe. Because you need that oxygen, right, to make that to make all that ATP. Okay. All right. And once that energy is in ATP, energy can be released, right? Because that covalent bond, because those two phosphate groups is broken, and it's a high energy bond, right? Through a hydrolysis reaction. All right. So what do we got right here? Page 2. Ooh, okay. All right. So that's kind of an important part of the class to know. All right. So is ATP hydrolysis anabolism or catabolism? It's catabolism, right? That's energy releasing process. Don't forget, anabolism is the reverse of that. Yeah, it requires energy. Could you give me a couple processes of ATP anabolism? What are some processes that we've been talking about? Anabolism of ATP is what? Building it up. What kind of processes build ATP? Would be aerobic respiration and or anaerobic respiration. So any kind of respiration is an anabolic process, right? All right, but it requires energy in order to make ATP. Where does that energy come from? What molecule? That's the organelle. But what's the molecule that started glycolysis? Is glucose, right? Is glucose. Okay. All right, so let's talk about another kind of important organic molecule in your body, and that is a nucleic acid. Nucleic acids make both DNA and RNA, and DNA is your genetic material. DNA contains the blueprint on how to make your body, you know, how it's put together, how all the pieces are put together. But if your body is put together the right way, guess what? What do you have that comes along with that structure? You have, you know, I don't, I'm going to pass one around. I would like to have a sign-in sheet. Okay, but let's ponder, as I find my sign-in sheet, let's ponder that question. Okay, so the DNA defines how to build your body, okay, it defines the structure of your body, but what does that really mean? If you have a normal structure of your body, what about, what does that impart to your body? If a protein has a normal structure, it has also a normal function. All right, so if your body is put together properly, if it has the right structure, what does it have? The right function as well. All right, so not only does DNA define how to put your body together, it also defines the proper function for your body because structure and function are related to each other. All right, where's my sign-in sheet? Right here. All right, because of that. Let's use this piece of paper. Ah, can't. Here, let's use this piece of paper. Okay, so DNA is important because it contains the blueprint on how to make your body. All right, and if it's made in a normal way, what about the function? You have a normal function too, right? So the DNA has those two important aspects to it. It defines how to build your body, but also how it functions properly. So it controls how to build it and how it functions. All right, so just like for a protein, we learned what the building block of a protein is. What's the building block of a protein? Amino acid. The building block of a nucleic acid is a nucleotide. Yeah, sign in please. This is a nucleotide. Okay. And a nucleotide actually looks a lot like an ATP molecule right here. What did an ATP have? It had a sugar, had a base, and it had some phosphates on it. Three phosphates for ATP. Well, nucleotide has a 5-carbon sugar. It's either going to be a deoxyribose or a ribose sugar. It's got a phosphate group, so it's only got one of these yellow things on there. Okay, it's only got one. And it's got a nucleotide base, and there can be one of 5 different kinds of bases. Where was that base located at? Sticking out. Here's the sugar. It's sticking up over here. All right, it's kind of sticking up and off to the side. That's a base. All right, and Some of these bases are a double ring structure, like I see right here, so the size is big. Some of them only have a single ring, which means that they're kind of small. And I just sort of tell you that in passing. I don't want you to know which ones are purines or pyrimidines, which ones are big or small, right? I just want you to know that there's a difference in shape. But what I do want you to know are the different names for the bases, which means that the nucleotide changes name. Some of the bases are made out of adenine. Some are made out of guanine. Others are made out of thymine, cytosine, or uracil. So there's only five different names, right? The sugar and the phosphate bound together, the base is attached to that one end of the molecule. That's the five-carbon sugar over here, the fifth position. Okay, so let's talk about DNA first. The sugar that's used in DNA, I'll have to draw this in. So I'll erase it. Okay. Right in this location, if it's DNA, there's just going to be, what's H stand for? A hydrogen atom. Okay, that's DNA. But if it's, so there's two kinds of nucleic acids, either DNA or RNA, right? And if it's RNA, you don't have just a hydrogen right there, you have an OH group, yeah, hydroxyl group. So the difference between DNA and RNA is what? The difference of just that little oxygen, kind of small in my impression, right? Not much difference between DNA and RNA. So this right here, because it's missing the oxygen, we call that a deoxyribose. And this one, if an OH is there, we call that just a plain old ribose, sugar. So this is deoxyribose. So guess where DNA gets its name from? Deoxyribose, right, nucleic acid. And RNA gets its name because that's not a deoxy. It actually has the oxygen. It's just a ribonucleotide, right, or ribose nucleotide. So that's a big difference between DNA and RNA. Not a really big difference. Okay. So DNA has got what? It's missing the oxygen. So as we call it, the deoxyribose sugar. Here are the bases that are found in DNA. We have adenine and thymine, cytosine and guanine. And notice in DNA, we never have any uracil. There's never uracil in there. Okay, and the way to remember these nucleotide bases is with this little saying right here, all turtles chew grass, because the A in all stands for adenine, turtles stand for the T in thymine, chews, the C stands for the C in cytosine, and grass, the G in grass stands for the G in guanine. Okay, so that might be a way for to help you remember. Okay, well, DNA always exists as a double-stranded molecule. All right, so there are two parts to it. There are two strands, and they come together. Let's see what kind of picture I have of DNA. Here's a pretty good molecule of DNA right here. Okay, but before I show you this, I want to say something about RNA. Okay, RNA has got the little oxygen on the ribose sugar, but the base is also different. In RNA, you have adenine and uracil instead of thymine, and you have cytosine and guanine. So that's an easy way to tell the difference between a DNA and an RNA molecule, because DNA is going to have thymine, and RNA is going to have uracil. So when I show you this right here, can you tell me if that's a DNA molecule or an RNA molecule, and maybe why?
DNA.
Well, that was awfully fast. Okay, why? How could you tell me? Oh, because there's, oh yeah, oh, I circled it right here. Okay, there's a thymine. All right, so there's a thymine. All right, and what else could you tell me about this molecule? How many strands do you see right here? You see two strands. That's another characteristic of DNA. DNA is going to be double-stranded. RNA is always going to be just a single strand. It's going to be single stranded. So that's another way that you could tell right away that this is a DNA molecule. Okay. All right. What else do I see on this figure that's pretty important? Notice that the linkages between the two strands is accomplished by association between the bases of the nucleotides. All right, which is what part? That is this part right here. All right, that's the base of a nucleotide. All right, and can you tell, do you see a pattern? If you see a thymine on one strand, what do you see on the other strand? Is that always the case? 100% of the time. Okay? So we call that a base pair rule. Adenine can only base pair with thymine, and guanine can only base pair with cytosine. Never any other case because of the shape of these molecules. All right? It won't fit together in order to form this nice double-stranded kind of molecule. Okay, so that's what we call the base pair rules for DNA. The base pair rules are AT or GC. And it doesn't matter which way you say it. You could say CG or TA, it doesn't matter. But most people just say AT and GC. That's the base pair rules for DNA. And the kind of chemical bond between these base pairs right here is a very weak bond. Did we ever talk about bonds in here? What kind of bonds did we learn about? Covalent bonds, ionic bonds, and hydrogen bonds. Which one's the strongest? Covalent. Which one's the weakest? Hydrogen. These are hydrogen bonds right here. So that means what? These bonds, they're very, very weak. So you know what this molecule can do? It can unzip, and it can zip back together again very easily because these hydrogen bonds are so weak. All right, but there's so many of them, okay, that it actually can hold this molecule together. All right, so I think we're going to maybe start here next time. All right, and we'll finish comparing DNA and RNA next time. Okay? Yeah. Oh, yeah. How about right here? Got it. I understand. It's a frigid winter in Southern California.